The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with the assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings and welcome to today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood, the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Also, greetings to people in Hamilton and the Waikato on Free FM, to the Wairarapa on Arrow FM, and to Canterbury and Christchurch on Plains Media. Today, we have an interview with outstanding financial analyst Shamabile Yacob. It's a full interview, so let's get on with it. Economist Shamabile Yacob was an easy choice to invite into our Front Footing the Future series. I've long admired his incisive ability to integrate economic issues with the likes of social and environmental imperatives. And when I researched further for this interview, such as reading the authoritative Ellen Clark Foundation report on social cohesion, and Shamabile was a co-author of that, I found so much more that resonated with me that I'll need to be careful this conversation doesn't run for 2 or 3 hours. Shamabile, it's such a delight to welcome you to Climate Matters, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Maybe I could just start with a pretty open question by inviting you to discuss what's currently the most pressing climate-related issue in your mind.
I think fundamentally, we don't have a climate knowledge problem. There is a lot of knowledge that already exists. What we have is a problem of making the right choices when it comes to the climate. We keep on choosing to defer those choices, mainly because there are no painless choices. There will be some trade-offs that are required, some pain that's required to be shared, and gains that are required to be shared. To me, it feels like we think about climate as this separate thing rather than a more fundamental definition of the problem that we face in society, which is we have all the tools at our disposal, but we are unable to overcome those individual pressures to make those decisions.
Building on that then, if we were to have a policy setting or maybe an attitude towards policy setting, how would you see that flowing from what you were just saying, Shamabile?
Yeah, I guess firstly, I think it's the framing of it. And I think there are two kind of aspects. One is that adaptation aspect, because I think we are already dealing with climate change today. And adaptation is something that we need to deal with today. And the second thing is that just transition aspect, because I think we do have to transition to doing things differently in the future. And in that process, we have to figure out who pays, who's protected, and how we get that balance right. And to do that from a policy perspective, again, good policy is not so much about the specifics of the policy, but how we make those policies. Because I think what I can see in terms of climate change policy, it's more like a relay race rather than a sprint. So the sprints are perhaps the electoral cycles. Between those periods, we have to pass the baton on so that we have policies that are durable, that are predictable, and continue to be redistributive. Otherwise, what happens is we're dealing with this very long-term complicated problem with short-term volatile policies, and that's just a recipe for disaster. So to my mind, it's less about the specifics of the policy and that we haven't agreed on a broad enough suite of policies that we can stick with over a long period of time.
Yes, thank you for that. And in fact, that comes back to the whole business of multilateral or cross-party agreements and so on, which we've taken a step into that space and then seem to have retreated from a bit, don't we? So hopefully we can get back into that again.
I think it's entirely possible that we'll get back to it, but I have a little frustration that we are relying on politicians to come up with the solution and to provide that endurance, rather than recognizing that actually that endurance needs to come from the public. So a lot of the reasons why we see the politics being so volatile is because the politicians can see that it's a way to divide and conquer their population and win the next election. So I don't think we can always point the finger and say the politicians are the problem and the politicians are the solution, when actually it's us who haven't got a consensus in terms of what we want to do with climate change.
Thank you. That's a super perspective, and thank you for adding it to what we were talking about. And in a way, it gives me a good segue into the next topic I'd like to pick up on. In the introduction, I mentioned the social cohesion report that you were involved with at the Helen Clark Foundation. Although that report didn't expressly address this issue, it included relevant references to the benefits of social cohesion, such as a greater ability of citizens to take longer-term views, which obviously we think is important, or to participate in democratic processes. What do you see as the relevance of social cohesion in terms of formulating and implementing good climate policy? And I think that builds on what you were just saying.
It does. So social cohesion, in my mind, is not that we don't have differences within society, but that we can meet across difference. We can hold those differences. We are willing to change our minds when we share our worries and hopes and dreams with each other. And then we're able to kind of navigate that complexity together. And it's the together part. It's working together to a common purpose. That's what social cohesion looks like. And so until we kind of think, you know, until we kind of have enough social cohesion, it's really hard for us to be able to deal with those big issues. So going back to my kind of earlier analogy, if you think about those long-term policymaking, particularly around climate, as more like a relay race, then social cohesion is the bit that allows us to stay consistent between electoral cycles.
Yes, I love that. And I'm going to jump into a topic area which I had thought to come to a bit later. And that's the role of deliberative democracy in our society, citizens' assemblies and so on. Have you got any strong views on those as possible avenues for the future, Shamabeel?
Absolutely. So I think what's really beautiful about something like a deliberative model is it moves away from what we do currently, which is vote, consult, and consume. So it's a very linear, transactional thing. Whereas with a deliberative approach, we kind of make those citizens expert citizens for a while. They are furnished with the expert insight. They're given the time and the space to deliberate and contemplate, which we very rarely get to do on with depth and expertise and support. And I think that's the difference between, I think, being a citizen who votes, which I think is almost like the fast food version of citizenship, versus a citizen who's able to contemplate, really understand the issues, and then work together with your fellow citizens to reach a solution that's good enough for everyone. And there are some examples of this, right? What happened in terms of that approach in South Dunedin, what they've done in Westport. None of them are perfect, but by God, that's a hell of a lot better than people just flinging arguments against each other.
I'm totally with you. And it seems to me that there's a popular misunderstanding that it's just a sort of consultation on steroids, but the word deliberative is a very important part of that process, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, again, let's not be too optimistic about it, in that even in a deliberative democracy model, quite often it's going to be the people with the most resources who participate, unless we take a very deliberate approach to make sure we get that cross-section of society there. And so deliberative democracy, when done well, is extraordinarily powerful. The way I think about it is currently our local government and government engage in what I'd call consultation. And it's a consultation of convenience. So what we get is those who are disproportionately already advantaged, who are time rich, confident, system literate, they're the civic makers who get that influence and input into decision making. And because we don't recognize that, we think that consultation gives us a deliberative or good democratic outcome. And so unless you recognize that the current model of democracy is in fact not democratic, you won't see the benefit of a deliberative democratic process.
Right. Thank you. As I said at the beginning, I think we could talk for hours on a lot of these topics, but I better move us on, Shamabeel, into a further area which I know you've been involved with, and that's the question of income inequality. And I'm very interested in that. And I was really delighted when I was reading the social cohesion report that it referenced Wilkinson and Pickett, the spirit level, which to me is quite a touchstone of a research model. I'm not steeped in that area, but I think they make some very good points. Are you in a position to outline for listeners the core tenets of that work and where New Zealand sits in that context?
Sure. I mean, The Spirit Level is not a perfect book. No book is perfect. No research is perfect. But I think it has some pretty simple lessons that resonate very strongly with me. And what it says is that inequality makes us sicker, makes us more anxious, and less able to trust each other. So when it comes to this topic that we're talking about today, which is climate, it's actually not a side issue. It's the foundation. Mm-hmm. So if you have people who are sick and anxious and unable to trust each other, how are you going to agree on a set of policies and actions that will have winners and losers?
One of the findings that struck me out of the book, The Spirit Level, was that often the better off people were actually happier in a society that was less unequal from an income point of view. Am I reading that correctly there? Is that your understanding of it?
Generally speaking, when you've got less inequality, everybody is happier. So I think there is an element of that relative poverty that has quite a big impact.
I want to take a big sideways step now into energy in the economy, because it's lovely for me to be talking to someone who's in the economics field, because I've spent quite a lot of time in the technical side. There's a long-standing but little discussed view that we actually run an energy economy, not a monetary one. And that energy is not a derived demand, as it's often referenced, but is actually something that shapes our society. If we take that further, I'm going to get a little bit technical. The parameters of renewable energy, two of them that are problematic are A, it's high energy cost as a portion of the energy we get, and B, the fact that we still need a fossil fuel industry to develop its infrastructure, at least as far as we do now. And therefore, we might struggle to actually sustain an economy with our renewable energy. Do you have views on that, Shamabil?
Yeah, probably less linear than how you might have outlined it. So I think I'll grant you the point that economics does treat energy as an input, but not as a limit. And I think it can be both of those things, right? Mm-hmm. There are serious biophysical limits, and we need to think about how we take both of those into account. But I would push back against kind of thinking about it as an inevitable collapse, you know, that limits to growth, peak oil kind of idea. Those are kind of, we've had those conversations in the past. And the reason I push back is because we have seen real evidence that we can become more efficient, we can substitute, we can innovate. And, you know, our energy intensity in the economy has fallen for a number of decades. So it's still not enough, but we're making progress. So a lot of the progress in terms of prosperity is not just about more inputs. It's also about us getting better. And I think if we think that we're going to get richer by just throwing more inputs at it, that I will concede is not likely. But in terms of our ability to get smarter, more efficient, to be able to substitute into other ways of doing things, I'd like to hope that we're still able to do that. The question isn't really about if growth ends, because it's almost the wrong question. I think it's about whether we can ensure there is enough prosperity and opportunity for people. But more importantly, whether the transition is going to be disorderly. I think therein lies the big risk, right? If we kind of go that all the costs of this transition to a different energy system is going to be borne by poor people, then I think we're going to destroy the fabric of society and create massive problems in the future.
Yeah, that's fair enough, I think, Shamabil. And one of the things there, I think, is you touched on transport a minute ago. And transport, of course, is a major part of our energy consumption. I've enjoyed interacting with some of your reports previously when I've given talks on carbon and building and that sort of thing. And I've piggybacked on some of yours, which were housing and transport. What sort of policy settings do you feel a government should really be targeting in order to get our built environment, and I'm meaning across the buildings and the transport infrastructure, to get our built environment sort of climate responsible and as future-proof as we might make it?
Yeah, look, I think the starting point is we treat housing, transport, and climate as three different issues. But they're not. They're clearly part of one system. And, you know, if we can build the right cities, then we kind of deal with three of those problems all at the same time. And so the answer is, and this has become very dogmatic, ideological, the answer actually is compact and well-connected cities that will reduce our transport emissions, lower our housing costs, and we can, you know, build the density that supports public transport. Because we can't have lots of sprawl, lots of cars, and hope that somehow emissions are going to fall. It's just not going to happen.
No, it's an oxymoron almost, isn't it? We're in an election year, Shamabeel, and I don't know whether you want to go into the political space at all, but I've picked up in researching for this that you described both the 2023 budget and this year's one as typical election year budgets.
Yeah.
And you also made observations that struck me that the good times are always spoken of as just around the corner, and the big infrastructure promises often end up being unfulfilled. Plus, the Social Cohesion Report found that UK initiatives were too focused on capital works and insufficiently on building community strength. If you were tasked with writing a manifesto for responsible social and climate policies in New Zealand, what sort of things would you like to see in it? What would it look like?
I think you're absolutely right in that our budgets and election manifestos are very focused on, one, winning the election, and two, doing as much as they can in the three-year period. But policies that require multiple political terms are very rarely given that thought and support to do that well. So if I were given that opportunity kind of to work on these kinds of things, I think the focus would be not necessarily on the what, but the how. How would we have ways of making decisions on issues that allows us to do things differently? And so that might be to do with whether we have independent organizations like commissions, or more transparency, more accountability mechanisms, multi-year funding commitments. So it has to be kind of almost tricking the system to think beyond the political cycle. So if you want to move beyond that, we have to kind of do something. And I'm not quite sure because I'm not entirely sure what that looks like. But I think a lot of it is to do with making sure that we are spending money in ways that are different, building ways of doing government that are different, not always about spending and regulating, but also about being convening powers of being people who kind of create those processes of deliberation. And that's a real difficulty for politicians because they don't want to let go of that power. It's that idea of perseverance, right? Like there are so many of these ideas, particularly around those big policies, whether it's around energy or climate or housing, you can't have things that just go stop-start. So I think we also need to understand that once we stop fighting about whether there is a problem and we're fighting about the solutions, it may not be consistent, but progress can be made.
Maybe I should have picked this up a little earlier when we were talking about income inequality, but I don't want this to be too politically specific, but I'm interested that the Opportunity Party has put out a form of universal basic income. You've mentioned a couple of times we need to try and do things differently. Do you have a view on the role that might play, Shamabeel?
Yeah, look, I'm not going to tell you who to vote for, but I guess things like a guaranteed income and a land tax, those are very serious attempts to go, how can we give more people more security and incentives to think long-term? And I think that's the connection with how we kind of create that game, that long-term game for climate change. The challenge with these policies, of course, is that something like a UBI and a land tax both run against a pretty strong incumbency. The people who are currently not paying very much tax obviously don't want to do that.
So that's not a saying they're not a good idea. It's just the realities of how we get them across the line.
Totally. I mean, we already have tools that are pretty good. Like if I had my way, we would absolutely have a tax on capital, and land makes a lot of sense because it's a capital that can't run away. But a wealth tax of some sort would be really useful because that would mean that our tax burden is shared more equally to those who can afford it. I would like to see our welfare system becoming more generous, more supportive of helping people move out of poverty, which it currently doesn't do. And also, you know, we talked about earlier before, I think in passing, that we see that in citizenship, in democracy, it's those with resources who participate the most. But we want to make sure that everybody has enough resources to both to invest in themselves individually, but also to invest in their citizenship, Woody.
No, it's getting from here to there that's half the problem sometimes, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, you know, we do have to grapple with these issues, but we also know that in New Zealand, our history shows we will only grapple with them when there is a crisis of a very large proportion.
Yes, and one that we recognise, and probably a quick crisis, because we've got a slow climate crisis that I think the pace of it is one of the things that rather hoodwinks people, isn't it?
Well, I think it did. But, you know, when I've been doing a lot of work in insurance, and what's very clear is it's no longer a slow moving and a small thing anymore. It is a fast moving, large cost. You know, I look at our insurance, reinsurance costs, for example. They used to be something like 0.1% of GDP. Now they're close to 1% of GDP. That's a tenfold increase in the cost of getting insurance. That's because those reinsurers can see that we are risky. So climate change is not a problem of the future. It's here today. And I think the insurance sector is going to force many of those conversations, because if we don't have them, we're going to lose coverage. We're going to create ghettos where poor people live because there is no insurance. And that is not a New Zealand I want to see.
No, I'm totally with you on that. And the insurance company, I think they're realistic and their actuaries are switched on enough to send the warning signals that a lot of other people...
Well, I think they've also been quite reactive. So let's not give them too much credit. They're human just like us. So if you look at when the costs increase, it's after every disaster. So after Canterbury, they suddenly realize that earthquake is a peril that needs to be priced. After the floods, after the storms, each time they have added new perils. It would be cheaper for us to try and create those investments in adaptation and managing and reducing those risks rather than looking to transfer those risks.
And in fact, I was framing a question in my mind as you started to say that, because you mentioned a moment ago that the reinsurance costs were sitting at somewhere around about 1%. And in my reading and so on, quite often a figure of 2% of GDP is put out as the sort of figure we should invest in climate responses to expect to turn the tide a bit on it.
Yeah, well, I think it's less about the quantum of money. I think everybody thinks it's additional investment, but I think it's the way we invest. You know, we can't make stupid decisions and build on floodplains and, you know, next to places that are prone to erosion and all those other bits and pieces. So we already have enough knowledge. So I think there is an element of knowledge that's important that we keep on investing in. And the second part is, as we invest, as we renew, we have to make really strong decisions in terms of what we keep, what we maintain, and what we stop. A lot of it, I think, is not necessarily that we need to throw more money at it, but I think we do need to think about it in terms of how do we make sure the investments we do make take climate change into consideration. So in my mind, climate change is not a vertical, it's not a line item. It's something that should run across every decision that we make.
I would like, before we get completely to the end, I'd like to just give you the chance to, if there's anything else that you think, oh, I'd really like to put this out there to the listeners. So I'd be very interested to hear if you had anything else on mind.
Sure. Look, I think partly it's about how do we find optimism and hope, because so many of the conversation around climate change, social cohesion, inequality, they feel intractable and impossible to resolve. And yet, I would say that I'm not a doomer in the sense that I think there is reasons for optimism, particularly in a country like New Zealand. So the reason I do work on social cohesion is not because I want to find what the problems are, but because I want to know how to bring back the cohesion that we did have. So when I look at those problems we talked about before, like the post-war state housing program, the near fully renewable electricity network that we have, we already have the capacity. It's proven in our history. It's in our DNA. So the constraint is actually choice rather than capacity. So to me, it's a little bit more of a civic call. So, you know, when we think about climate, housing, inequality, they're all the same problems with different hats, right? It's all about the underlying thing in terms of, are we able to come together to share some costs so then we can share future benefits?
Yes, I agree with you. And right at the beginning, you made the reference that it was a bit like a relay race and not a sprint. And you were talking about the baton being passed from one term of parliament to another. But at the same time, it went through my mind that you could say the relay is from one generation to another too, couldn't you? And in that sense, what you were just saying is exactly in that space.
Totally. I think, you know, that intergenerational equity, we want to leave our children and grandchildren better off as our parents and grandparents wanted for us. So it's, I think it's only fair and right that we don't sit here and extract and destroy things for future generations, because that's just not right.
Samuel, I think we'll call it to a close now. That's been wonderful talking with you. We've made good progress on what was quite a long list of topics I put out in front of you. So thank you so much for joining us. I've enjoyed it very much. Look forward to having contact another time.
Thanks very much.
Aren't we lucky to have someone like Shamabeel on the show? Be great if some of his ideas appeared in climate policy. Next week's guest is Mirjana Stevens. Mirjana wakapapa's Te Ngāti Rangi, Te Ngāti Ranganui, and Te Ngāti Rārua. And she brings a wealth of business experience strongly blended with Te Ao Māori and a sustainability ethos. And then following that, we have Victoria Mulligan. Victoria is a professional futurist, a certified foresight practitioner, and brings us great ways of envisaging the future. So I do hope I have you in company for those interviews, and of course, kia kaha for the climate. As you know, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson-Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.co.nz, for our contact details.